They're happy to be going back to get another chance to continue to advance the commitment that Chairman Kim and President Trump made back in Singapore.
The top U.S. diplomat prepares for another trip to Pyongyang. We'll explore what might lie ahead. This is October 4th, Thursday. This is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. You can join us on VOA Asia Facebook and let us know what's on your mind. Also ahead, the death toll soars even higher following the Indonesian earthquake and tsunami. Improving relations between the U.S. and Pakistan might depend on one of Pakistan's neighbors. And you'll hear a plan underway to replenish trees in a portion of Bangladesh. All on VOA Asia. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will return to Pyongyang this coming Sunday for talks with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un.
They're happy to be going back to get another chance to continue to advance the commitment that Chairman Kim and President Trump made back in Singapore in the second week of June. I'm optimistic that we'll come away from that with better understandings, deeper progress, and a plan forward, not only for the summit between the two leaders, but for us to continue the efforts to build out a pathway for denuclearization.
That was an echo of what State Department spokeswoman Heather Nauert indicated Tuesday, that she said that the conversation over denuclearization will move forward.
We continue to have these conversations, and I think it shows forward progress and momentum that the secretary is making his fourth trip back in less than a year. The first, of course, was as CIA director. This will be his third as Secretary of State. And that shows the president's commitment to the agreement that he and Chairman Kim came to at the Singapore summit. The secretary going on for follow-on conversations. As we often say, the conversations continue. Of course, we have quite a ways to go, but we look forward to the next steps in this conversation. We're hopeful. We're working toward that goal. Everyone recognizes that we have a way to go and a lot of work that is left to be done. I'm not going to get ahead of the secretary's meetings that he'll have in Pyongyang, but I know he looks forward to continuing the conversation.
She said the U.S. has not changed its policy and will maintain a regime of international sanctions until the North denuclearizes. In contrast, North Korean Foreign Minister Ri Yong-ho told the U.N. last week maintaining sanctions only deepens the North's mistrust of the U.S. and would not harm unilaterally. He said Pyongyang had taken significant goodwill measures such as halting nuclear and missile testing and dismantling a nuclear test site with no response from Washington. Joshua Pollack, senior research associate at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, challenged the notion the U.S. has done nothing since Singapore.
The United States stopped the combined exercises with South Korea at the summit. So the president agreed to it on the spot without consulting the South Koreans. To say that the United States has done nothing is unfair. But Foreign Minister Ri has clearly a story to tell, and the story is that there's a deadlock, and it's the fault of the United States. He does not exactly portray the way out of this deadlock other than a change of heart on sanctions relief. That is going to be a difficult conversation when Secretary Pompeo gets to Pyongyang again.
As far as the North Korean foreign minister's claim that the U.S. has offered no response after his country had made significant goodwill gestures, Pollack said that this has been the U.S. stance for quite some time.
It's pretty consistent with what the United States has been saying since the start of the Trump administration, that there will not be sanctions relief piecemeal or along the way for anything less than the total satisfaction of American objectives on the North Korean nuclear program. And that is clearly not to the liking of the North Koreans. The foreign minister in his UN remarks commented that the Security Council should have taken some sort of action to reverse or relax measures under resolutions against North Korea in response to a year without North Korean missile tests or nuclear tests. That's a very different understanding of how this process should unfold. It just underscores that the Singapore agreement was really a set of broad common objectives. It was not an agreement on how to reach them.
Joshua Pollack said last month's inter-Korean summit reinvigorated the denuclearization process with a statement issued by the two leaders who said it was, he said, was sufficiently pleasing to Washington to prepare for a second summit. Secretary Pompeo will also make stops in Seoul, Tokyo, and Beijing, where he's slated to hold talks on bilateral, regional, and global issues. That visit comes at a time of heightened Sino-U.S. tensions over trade and security matters. These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. U.S. President Donald Trump is checking Beijing's expansion in the South China Sea. Some say he's using those military moves to pressure China on trade as well. A Japanese observation robot has landed on an asteroid on a mission to shed light on the origins of the solar system. Thailand is shutting down its pristine Thai Bay, immortalized in the movie The Beach, to allow it to recover from the impact of hordes of tourists. Chinese movie star Fan Bingbing is fined millions in a high-profile tax evasion case. India, in a first, sends 7 Rohingya for deportation to Myanmar. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook and VOA Asia and on the voanews.com website. This is VOA Asia. Indonesian President Joko Widodo returned Wednesday to the earthquake and tsunami-devastated northwestern Sulawesi Island for his second visit as the death toll from Friday's 1-2 natural disaster climbed past 1,400, with hundreds injured and missing and tens of thousands displaced. The military delivered more supplies by cargo aircraft as more than 24 countries and international organizations, including the U.S., gear up to provide funding, personnel, and humanitarian aid. One of those groups already on the ground is the U.S.-based private humanitarian development and advocacy organization World Vision, which has an office in the hard-hit port city of Palu. Priscilla Kristen is a spokeswoman based in Jakarta who spoke with VOA's Victor Beatty about what World Vision is doing. Now, keep in mind, telephone communication with Palu is still quite iffy at best. Please listen carefully.
We built a public kitchen near our office area. And also we distribute the family kit, consists of the blanket, the tarpaulin, the towel, and also the hygiene kit to the affected community and the children.
How difficult is it getting teams into the affected area?
It's challenging, but we keep trying and do our best because of the limited of the gasoline, and also the roads were blocked and collapse, and also now it's coming more on the security issue. Since the people are coming and make the street crowded, they're looking for a help, they're asking for a support from the people who come to distribute the kits. They are coming and asking for a further support. That's why the looting happened, and that's why we need to coordinate further with the local police, with the National Disaster Agency, when we do the distribution program.
What kind of supplies are you able to provide?
We supply the food for the children, but it's still near our office area. And also we supply with the tarpaulin, with the blanket, with the towel, and all of the equipment to make them survive in the temporary shelter while the aftershock is still happening until yesterday.
Are there airports or ports available that you can use, or do you have to travel over land to get there?
Before this earthquake happened, actually we have a program, the development program in Palu. That's why some of the staff is already there. But when the additional team come to the field, to the Palu, we need to take a travel by plane 2 hours and then fly again 2 hours and then take the road trip around 12 hours. And now, actually, I will go there to Palu, and I'm still looking for a way to reach Palu. It takes a time to fly, and also the availability of the airplane is very, very limited.
Priscilla Kristen said World Vision's staff of 12 is coordinating with local agencies to provide supplies, including food, at designated locations, with an emphasis on meeting the needs of the region's children and infants. Now, the UN Children's Fund warns that tens of thousands of child survivors of the devastating earthquake and tsunami Friday in Sulawesi are unprotected and vulnerable to exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva. The death toll is expected to rise.
The full extent of the disaster is still emerging, but the UN Children's Fund says it is very worried about its impact upon the children, as they are most vulnerable in crisis emergency situations. UNICEF says it is especially concerned about the children's welfare and safety as the Sulawesi tsunami follows by 1 month the earthquake in the holiday island of Lombok. That event killed 550 people and displaced 340,000. The agency reports children comprise more than one-third of the population of central Sulawesi. It says 43% of the children live in poverty. As a result of poor nutrition, it says a great many children suffer from chronic malnutrition or stunting. This condition makes children more prone to disease and infection and impairs their physical and mental development. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouygerac says his agency is very concerned about the many children who are likely to have become orphaned or separated from their parents by the disaster and have no one to protect them.
This is also a region with a low birth registration. Only 33% of children are registered. And birth registration is of paramount importance in terms of child protection. It is a passport to protection. This low birth registration is an issue for family tracing process, in addition to well-known risk of exploitation and trafficking.
Children who have no birth certificate are officially invisible. They cannot access basic services such as health, social welfare, and education. They are at risk of being trafficked, sexually exploited, and forced into child labor. UNICEF says it is deploying social workers to the affected areas to provide psychosocial services for separated and unaccompanied children and to trace and reunify families. It is appealing for $5 million to provide essential needs. These include medical and health services, water and sanitation, food and non-food items, and emergency shelter. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, Malaysia's anti-graft agency says the wife of former Prime Minister Najib Razak will be charged under the Anti-Money Laundering Act. The agency says Rosma Mansour was detained about 4 hours after she arrived for a third round of questioning over alleged theft and money laundering at the 1MDB State Investment Fund. Stay up to date with VOA. This is VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us. Both the United States and Pakistan say they want to improve their relationship, but the war in Afghanistan remains a major obstacle. The U.S. State Department made clear that the foundation for a strong partnership between the U.S. and Pakistan is a partnership for peace and stability in Afghanistan. VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports from the State Department.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo welcomed Pakistani Foreign Minister Shah Mahmood Qureshi to the State Department Tuesday after both expressed eagerness to improve strained ties. The relationship between Washington and Islamabad, officially allies in fighting terrorism, had plunged to its lowest point over allegations Pakistan has covertly enabled the Taliban insurgency to sustain the war in neighboring Afghanistan. Senior State Department official Alice Wells told VOA Afghanistan would be a focus of Tuesday's meeting.
We've been very clear that this needs to start with a partnership in promoting stability and peace in Afghanistan. At various times over the last year, the Trump administration has expressed its disappointment that we've not yet found that way to work together to bring the Taliban to the negotiating table. So this will obviously be at the top of the agenda.
Pakistan says it wants to turn a new page in ties with the U.S. And Foreign Minister Qureshi hinted at a possible compromise in one irritant, the fate of Shakil Afridi, the Pakistani doctor jailed after helping the U.S. find and kill al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. Qureshi indicated the newly elected government of Prime Minister Imran Khan might be more flexible on the issue. But State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert said there is no news on that front.
Yeah, I think they've been saying that for quite some time, that there could be some movement on that. We have yet to see that.
Both sides say they have had productive meetings and are working toward better ties. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Stay with us. Coming up, an attempt to replace trees in areas of Bangladesh left barren by refugees. You're listening to VOA Asia.
What is it like to study in the United States, and what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
This news alert from VOA Asia, a volcano erupted Wednesday morning on the same central Indonesian island as an earlier earthquake, and authorities warned planes about volcanic ash in the air. Mount Saputan in South Sulawesi province spewed ash 6,000 meters into the sky Wednesday morning. No evacuations were immediately ordered. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features to see and share. This is VOA Asia. A tree planting project is underway in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, to undo the environmental damage caused by the huge influx of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya refugees who fled persecution and violence in Myanmar. The project, spearheaded by the International Organization for Migration and Food and Agriculture Organization, has planted more than 45,000 trees and around 700,000 grass cuttings over the past 2 weeks. Plans are to plant 36,500 more trees and 1 million grass cuttings during the coming days. The agencies report humanitarian agencies in Cox's Bazar have also planted about 200,000 saplings as part of this effort to stabilize soil and replant the denuded forest area. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says the project will help reverse the environmental damage caused by the sudden arrival of nearly 500,000 Rohingya refugees in August and September last year.
Hundreds of thousands of people arrived. A lot of acreage was stripped bare for firewood. That created a huge risk factor, especially with the monsoon season coming. Landslides, avalanches, hundreds of dwellings, simple dwellings are built on these muddy hills without the trees and the grass to anchor the soil. We risked a real catastrophe.
The Bangladesh Forest Department estimates around 7,000 hectares of forest has been damaged as a result of the refugee influx, which now stands at almost 1 million. Aid agencies are providing the refugees and local families in the area with LPG stoves to reduce reliance on firewood for fuel and to prevent further deforestation. IOM says the tree planting project also will be an economic boon for the Rohingya refugees and host community by providing livelihood opportunities. It says thousands of people will be engaged through IOM's cash for work programs to improve the environment. Our thanks to correspondent Lisa Schlein in Geneva, who contributed to this report. This news alert from VOA Asia, the mayor of Osaka, Japan, says he's ending a six-decade sister city relationship with San Francisco to protest a statute honoring women forced to have sex with Japanese soldiers during World War II. San Francisco Examiner reported Wednesday Osaka Mayor Hirofumi Yoshimura sent a letter to San Francisco officials announcing his withdrawing from the largely ceremonial relationship. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, one of Australia's biggest power companies says it will close a major coal-fired power plant as it invests in renewable resources and sources despite pressure from the government in Canberra to keep it open. From Sydney, Phil Mercer has more.
Run down, dangerous and expensive is how an Australian newspaper described the Liddell power plant, adding that it was the perfect symbol of the decline of the coal industry. The facility was completed in 1973, with an expected lifespan of 25 years, but it continues to generate power in a country that relies on coal to generate more than 60% of its electricity. The Australian government wants the plant to stay open for a few more years because of fears of power cuts and concerns about the potentially fragile state of the nation's energy sector. 2 years ago, wild storms damaged transmission cables, causing a blackout across the entire state of South Australia. Ministers are also worried about the political implications of household power bills that have soared in recent years. But energy giant AGL plans to decommission the facility in the New South Wales Hunter Valley in 2022 as it concentrates its commercial interests on renewable sources of energy, including solar and wind. The company insists its decision is economic and not ideological. Brett Redman, interim chief executive of energy company AGL, says that despite pleas from the government, the Liddell power station will close as scheduled in 4 years' time.
Our strategy to exit heavy carbon emitting facilities over the long term is unchanged. We continue in an operational sense to review our plants, but there's no change at this point to the Liddell exit date. I've spoken to and I've met personally Angus Taylor, the new energy minister. I found that to be a very comfortable meeting where he understandably is very worried about power price on behalf of Australia's consumers.
Australia remains heavily reliant on fossil fuels, not only for domestic power generation, but also for economic reasons. It exports billions of dollars worth of coking coal, currently a key ingredient in the making of steel and thermal coal, which is used for heat and power generation. Much is sold to China and into Southeast Asia. Conservationists argue, however, that the coal industry is waning, and that Australia should be vigorously pursuing alternative renewable sources. Despite Canberra's continued enthusiasm for coal, which in Australia is cheap and plentiful, Australia's energy mix is changing. There has been an increase in small-scale solar power generation, mostly through domestic roof panels, and more consumption of natural gas. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Residents of Mosul, one of the last major strongholds of the Islamic State extremist group in Iraq, used to live in constant fear. Creativity and free thought were discouraged, as was education, so doing something you were passionate about was unheard of. But a young Kurdish engineer had some other ideas. He believed it was his duty to capture what life was like in Mosul during ISIS's reign. As reporter Kawa Omer reports, his outlet was making toys and small models, each telling a story of life under terrorist occupation. Bezan Hamdard has more.
Like many who lived in Mosul in the dark days of the Islamic State, engineer Mustafa Ghassan lived in fear. He had no job, no creative pursuits, and too much time. So he started making toys and miniature objects out of ice cream sticks.
My hobby is to make small objects of different kinds and colors, of course from the available materials. The art of creating miniature-sized objects is called diorama art. This is an internationally well-known art, an art of making items representing any event and incident, but its size has to be small.
Each small object Ghassan creates has a story to tell and a message to convey. Ghassan says he wanted his creations to capture the fear and the stories of torture under ISIS rule. And he says each piece has a deep meaning for him and the people who buy his art objects.
There is a story behind each piece, a story related to the events that myself, my family, and my city went through. I remember making each object. Some of them remind me of happier times, but some, not so much.
Ghassan now works at Mosul University's engineering department, but he still makes toys and dioramas to remind him of Mosul's recent past and to appreciate what the city now has to offer, without forgetting the challenges that still lie ahead for the people of Mosul and Iraq. For Kawa Omer in Mosul, Iraq, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Greg Burns, our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy your day.